Hello, welcome to the Pen Press Podcast. My name is Stephanie Brown. In this podcast, I'll be speaking with John Cheng. John Cheng is the author of Astounding Wonder, Imagining Science and Science Fiction in Interwar America. Can you tell us a bit about how the general public perceives science and technology just after World War One?
As to how the public perceives science and technology just after World War One, it's complicated because World War One, in some ways, was the first technological war. They might have, you know, seen some of the sort of technologies applied to warfare. So, and you know, obviously, if you know anything about the history of World War One, you know that it was sort of, there were horrific casualties.
So it wasn't all positive.
It wasn't necessarily positive. But at the same time, you know, science was associated with this idea that of modernity, of the fact that, you know, that sorts of, all sorts of new things that were invented. And, you know, even if you didn't necessarily like it, you sort of knew that it was, you know, it had already changed things and it was going to continue to change things. People didn't have as much formal education or training in general, and then specifically in science and engineering. The majority of people, if they were lucky, had attended high school. And, you know, at the same time, there were many famous and celebrated examples of scientists and engineers, inventors who were not formally trained. So someone like Thomas Edison, the Wright brothers, Alexander Graham Bell, you know, many people who invented things sort of participated in the adventure of science and didn't have formal training.
Let's switch gears a bit and talk about Hugo Gernsback, actually, who was, as you say, the inventor of science fiction and the science fiction magazine. Tell us a bit about Gernsback's journey into science fiction publishing.
Okay. Gernsback was actually born in Luxembourg, so he was an immigrant. Was educated in Europe and then immigrated to the United States in 1905. And in some ways, he got into publishing indirectly because he basically started publishing a catalog of radio parts, and then, you know, occasionally had articles and things about radio in there. And, you know, it took off. And so he continued to publish magazines in that way. And then about 5 or 10 years later, he began to occasionally print fiction stories in some of his radio magazines. And they really sort of took off. And so in the early 20s, he experimented by publishing an entire issue of one magazine devoted to his you know, science, what we would now consider science fiction stories. And then at the same time, radio itself was changing. When Gernsback was first involved in it, the majority of people who were involved in radio were sort of amateur enthusiasts who used radio as a form of two-way communication. Kind of like, you know, what we use cell phones like for today, or actually a better example, I mean, the modern descendant is the ham radio. People were using radio as a way to talk to each other. And that was something that Gernsback thought was really important because he really believed in sort of, I mean, he believed that modernity was a good thing and that the best way to make progress was to have as many people get involved in science, in radio. I mean, radio was great because it was both an example of science and also a way for people to talk to each other.
And it's pretty evident in your book that he brought those ideas from radio into publishing.
Yeah, so Gernsback's radio business started to sort of, you know, decline, and he turned to science fiction as an alternative. You know, and also he had he began to make more money from publishing than in some ways from his radio operations. So he began he was looking for ways to make money, and in the context of the post-war period, there were a number of the pulps had sort of become more genre specific, and so he thought, well, you know, I can publish a pulp magazine that's devoted just to these sorts of stories. And so he published the first, he created the first science fiction magazine, which was amazing, in 1926.
That was the title of the magazine.
Yes, the title of the magazine was Amazing Stories. And it's interesting because he also, in order to promote the stories in the magazine, he had to give it a name. And the funny thing is that the first name that he gave it was a one word. I think it's kind of ugly, but it was science fiction, all one word.
Science fiction.
Yes, the name he gave to the fiction in that he had was publishing in Amazing. It's kind of an interesting story because he actually lost control of Amazing after a couple of years. And he was forced out, and he created another magazine called Science Wonder Stories. And to distinguish the fiction in that magazine from the fiction from his previous magazine, that's when he actually coined the term science fiction. He's actually the person who came up with both.
Okay. Now, getting back to Gernsback's kind of idealism, when he launches the magazine Science Wonder Stories, he declares that science fiction is a tremendous new force in America, and he says that the stories are clean from beginning to end, and they stimulated only one thing, imagination. So, I mean, that sounds like something kids would not want to read today. They really, you know, especially teens. So what drove Gernsback to emphasize the edifying value of his particular brand of entertainment?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, he did actually believe that science fiction was a tremendous new force. He thought that by basically publishing stories where writers imagined science, that it would help promote scientific and technological development.
And he had actual panels of scientists serve as associate editors. Is that
yes? Yes. And he, another one of his slogans was, he emphasized that science fiction was prophetic, that it would again predict things that would subsequently be invented or developed. The phrasing, you know, the concern about clean from beginning to end, they stimulate only one thing. That's actually a reference to other pulp magazines. The pulps were considered cheap. That was the phrase that was used. They were actually fairly expensive, although not necessarily everybody who read them bought them. But the phrase cheap had a lot to do with the fact, sort of cheap thrills. And also there was some concern that the pulps, particularly because their covers, were brightly illustrated. And some of them were, in fact, potentially sexually suggestive, lurid, titillating. So there was some concern about the sensationalism that, and about their moral character. And so Gernsback was really sort of addressing that to say science fiction, however, was not that way. Although, truth be told, there are some elements of that in some of the science fiction covers, some of the science fiction stories. I should also say that the pulps had this reputation, particularly among sort of social reformers, but in a sort of complicated way, they were actually the most morally wholesome stories that you could actually find.
Getting back to the particular magazines in the science fiction genre, a lot of them gave a considerable amount of space to the audience with features like the Reader's Corner and Discussions Corner. How did the readers use these spaces?
A couple things first. One reason that Gernsback actually gave a lot of space to these features was that he actually had a lot of space in his magazines. One drawback to inventing a new genre is you don't necessarily have a lot of people out there sort of writing fiction of that sort. And in pulp magazines, that you couldn't really put very much advertising. So he had to figure out sort of more creative ways to fill up space in his magazines. That said, the readers took full advantage of these letters to the editor columns. They wrote large numbers of letters, and they discussed everything from the stories to the artwork, the artists, the magazines themselves, including their like various formats and everything. That was true of other pulp magazines as well. Some of them carried letters columns, but the thing that really distinguished science fiction is how many letters they actually published. Well, and the last thing I was going to say is, and in the case of science fiction fans, well, readers also began to discuss the science in the stories, which then allowed them to realize that, that there were other people who were interested in the same sorts of fiction.
Okay.
Yes.
So it seems like from the start, science fiction fans were critiquing and debating the science within the stories and very with a lot of passion.
I looked at some of the letters, and you have literally have fans writing and, not only citing facts, but evoking theories, writing in, drawing diagrams, pictures, sort of providing equations and calculations to support their ideas. So it was very clear that they were very invested. The fans began to address not only the editors, but the writers and eventually each other. And so even though the letters they were technically considered letters to the editor, they would say, this is addressed to this fan. This is addressed to this letter. This is what you said. By the way, you were wrong. Going on and explaining on and on and on.
So, can you describe the typical science fiction reader in the 1920s and 30s? Was there a typical reader?
One thing that I would say there wasn't, but the part, I think the more relevant point is some of them thought that there were typical readers. It's actually very hard, and it's very difficult to know for sure. The standard perception was that the reader of a science fiction magazines was probably a young man, a teenager, or someone in their 20s who was interested in science. And there's some evidence that the majority of readers were male, but there were plenty of women who did read science fiction, and you can see that they felt that they had a different place because either they went out of their way not to identify that they were women by sometimes using their initials rather than their given names, or their first name. So you couldn't necessarily tell that it was a woman. Or in some cases, they were women who were very proud of the fact that they were women and just as good as men. And they would go out of their way and say, well, I am a 17-year-old girl and I study science. I have telescopes good as the men, so you shouldn't assume this. There were actually several examples of sort of mini love controversies that sort of sprang up in some of the letters columns where typically a man would say something or someone would say, science fiction, why do you have romance in the stories? Why did you why are there female characters? This is about science. Why are you polluting it with romance? And then people would say, well, there's a place for women in science. And people would say, no, they're not. Women. And they sort of go back and forth, which, by the way, the editors loved because it just meant that there was a lot of enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. There were actually a number of there are a number of women who went from readers to writing stories.
Jumping from the readers who are women, the writers who are women, to the characters who are women. it seems like in most of the stories, and of course there were exceptions, but most of the stories, the roles for women, the roles for men, were rather rigid, maybe by today's standards. One of the things you point out in your book is that at a certain point, there was a kind of a triangle. Could you give us an example of that kind of...
The best example that I could give of this kind of triangle is actually not necessarily from science fiction stories of the era per se, but actually from a comic strip at the time. And so Flash Gordon is the sort of archetypal hero. He's a all-American athlete who also attended Yale. He's the hero. His love interest, the heroine, is a woman by the name of Dale Arden. They're flying together on a plane that through a storm and wind up sort of crashing, and the two of them survive the crash, and they sort of stumble upon a scientist who by the name of Dr. Hans Zarkov, who basically explains to them that the storm that they crashed in is the result of this planet that's approaching the Earth, and that they have to go to the planet and try to stop it from colliding with Earth in order to save it. So he basically forcibly kidnaps the two of them onto a rocket, and off they go to this planet called which is called Mongo. And there they encounter the ruler of the planet, who's a man by the name of Ming the Merciless, who is technically an alien because he's from another planet, or what we would call an alien. But as the name and of the planet and of the character sort of implies, he is portrayed as an Asian. So they sort of form, so that you've got the three sort of protagonists and then the villain. The dynamic between hero and heroine is something that, you know, was borrowed from many other pulps. And they are, in some ways, archetypal sort of versions of sort of ideals for masculine and feminine behavior.
But the heroines were, they would get rescued. They would get into trouble and get rescued, basically. They weren't necessarily solving their own problems, or maybe they might kick somebody, but they weren't, you know.
Yes, I mean, one interesting thing is Dale Arden, in, you know, Flash Gordon's love interest, it was in fact quite feisty, in some ways her feistiness sometimes got her into trouble, but you know, it's actually pretty interesting. Flash Gordon himself and actually Dr. Zarkov, all of them also got themselves into trouble through their personality traits. So it wasn't as if the women were necessarily passive. Some of them were bland because they weren't particularly well drawn, but some of them were actually, you know, well enough portrayed that people that, particularly, I mean, women, or girls, identified with them. They were not characters in the way that you think of as, you know, you might think of as an interesting character in a novel. They existed for different purposes, to advance the plot and the story, which is what readers were, in some senses, interested in.
Getting back to Ming and Mongo. So frankly, a lot of these stories just sort of seem to reinforce white supremacy. And you know, although there you mentioned some, or generally, would you say, well, yeah, these were stories that were intended for a mainstream audience, and they sort of reflected mainstream views about race relations in the United States.
Yes, they did, although there are a few wrinkles. One distinction I'd make right off the bat is that, well, I mean, you're not necessarily wrong that they've been pretty much reinforced white supremacy. But I think, you know, there you can sort of think of white supremacy in two different ways. One is sort of an active, explicit, in-your-face, you know, the white race is supreme and you need to get rid of all other races, which was definitely actually present. I mean, the story that the Buck Rogers comic strip is actually based on was called Armageddon 2419 AD. And it literally was a story about a race war between the yellow and the white races in the 25th century. And the first story actually ends with Buck, well, actually, he's called Tony in the original story. Tony Rogers basically saying to Wilma Deering, his love interest, you know, we won't rest until the yellow blight is blasted from the face of the earth. So it's pretty explicit,
yeah.
You know, in that sense. But one thing, you know, one thing to sort of realize is that while there are definitely people who were very upfront about that, as you said, you know, there's another sense in which it reinforced white supremacy just simply because that was the assumed norm within society. And so if you know, there might have been, and there were examples of, people who, if they had thought about it, they might realize, oh, you know, there are these racial dynamics that are discriminatory against other groups. But if you happen to be white, or, you know, the trick of it is, if you happen to be white, you wouldn't notice it because you enjoyed the advantages, or what scholars call white privilege. So you typically wouldn't necessarily notice it unless you were a member of another group, as I said, like women or Asians.
And that brings me to a letter that you published in your book that, to me, was very poignant. It was written by a fan of Amazing Magazine and by a 13-year-old boy in New York City who identified himself as Chinese and said, I love this magazine. It's one of my favorite things. But why do you always, or so often, cast, as he puts it, Chinamen as the villains? Please don't always pick on them, he writes. I'm sure others would do.
Well, I think it's, you know, when I found the letter, I was actually quite astonished that it was published. But I think it's very indicative. I mean, it says a lot about, it got me thinking a lot about the sort of implicit racial dynamics that are in science fiction. And I did wonder, why would an Asian, a letter from an Asian American be published as opposed to an African American, when they were far more African Americans than Asian Americans. And one of the things that I address in the book is that, or sort of try to address, is that there are differences in different kinds of racial perceptions and dynamics. And so there are very few examples of African American or black characters in science fiction. Although there are a few, and I write about them in this one chapter. But it has to do with, as I argue in the book, it has to do with the slightly different perceptions about what race represented, what different races represented, and how that worked into the kind of themes and dynamics that science fiction was sort of addressing. And so, particularly because science fiction tended to want to look forward and be progressive, there weren't many examples of African Americans or African characters, because they were generally thought of as inferior and primitive, which is kind of the opposite of progress.
Mm-hmm. So they wouldn't be in the future, so to speak, simply put.
They wouldn't necessarily be in the future. I do write about this one story, you know, and the story basically revolves around people from the 20th century going into the future and leading a revolt of the black robots against the white masters. There are a few interesting examples, but not very many.
In the United States, where the relationship between black and white sort of takes center stage when people talk about racial discussions, but in these magazines, that was sort of a sideline to
Asians.
To Asians, yes.
Yes. So there were more Asian characters, you know. And when I say that there are Asian characters, I'm not saying that they were that every, you know, that you could, you know, half of the stories had them. They were definitely a minority, but there were enough of them that you definitely noticed them. Which actually got me to wondering, why are there these stories about Asians? To understand it, you kind of have to know a little bit about the history of Asian Americans. The most significant thing about Asian Americans, you know, the idea of Asian American, is it actually evolved out of a movement to exclude people of Asian descent from coming to the United States.
So there was this huge fear of
the exclusion of Asians, which is kind of an extension of segregation, really led to the idea that Asians in particular were the antithesis of what it meant to be American.
Hmm.
And so the argument was made that Asians of different racial groups were the most different from what you might think of as American character and values, that they would never assimilate. And so they were the ideal villains. That's why the most memorable villains that people tend to think of are people like Ming the Merciless, who, you know, Flash Gordon's nemesis. And one really interesting thing about this with regard to science fiction is when you have to imagine other worlds, other places, and, you know, their environments, it's actually very difficult to imagine in a vacuum. And so race and racial sort of representations tended to be borrowed from, sort of society and transplanted into science fiction. And having something like an alien, you know, I mean, if you just think, well, this is a creature that you just cannot understand, you know, that is something that evolves, that emerges slowly within science fiction. There's actually a famous story called Martian Odyssey that has the first sort of Martian creature whose mind just works in a way that's fundamentally different, that humans cannot possibly understand. Some people point to him or this character as the first true quote unquote alien in science fiction, although he's never referred to as an alien. He's talked to as an alien creature,
and this creature is not some sort of Ming like entity. This is totally.
He's kind of a sort of ostrich with arms that work. It is a fairly unusual story, because one of the things is he's one of the few aliens that isn't actually a villain. He's befriended by the human, and, you know, the human chemist who is the protagonist of the story. He says, you know, I don't really understand his mind. Don't know if I ever will, but it's pretty clear that, you know, he deserves respect, and we worked together.
So that sort of was someone who maybe transcended some of the racial or ethnic thinking, perhaps, of that half of the 20th century. If I could be more maybe a little overly optimistic, I don't know.
I mean, it is ironic, you know, going back and reading the story, which I had read as a child, or I guess in high school. When I was actually rereading again, I actually noticed that even in this, you know, generally celebrated as a very progressive story because of this character, even in that story, there is actually a reference to Asian, to real Asians, I guess I should say, earthling Asians, particularly in reference to a group called the Negrito, who occupy a particular place in American history as a quote-unquote primitive Asian group that was brought from the Philippines and actually exhibited at the St. Louis World's Fair as a kind of a primitive Asian group. And they're brought up in the context of the story as a sort of contrast to this Martian who is obviously superior.
This boy's letter opened up a discussion about race, but it can also bring us back to the discussion of the fan community, because I guess these letters were a gateway, like a gateway drug, in a way, for what we know and love today as the science fiction fan community.
I mean, it basically begins small. The letters that are published, the editors include the readers' address or the writers' addresses, mostly because, I mean, partially to fill up space, but partially because readers are actually requesting these addresses, and then because they can write to each other faster, more directly, as opposed to waiting for letters to be published in, you know, a monthly pulp magazine.
And obviously they don't, it's not like comments online or something. You need the address if you want to get in touch with someone.
Right. I mean, the analogy to sort of online discussions is not necessarily a bad one, because it's kind of the same phenomena, just happening, you know, using regular mail and happening a little bit slower. They used these magazines and then the mail and, you know, these addresses to form what we would today call social networks. They want to have these conversations, so they start writing to each other. Those people who discover they're in the same area start to form clubs and they meet regularly.
During the time period, there were the conventions that we know of today also got their start. How did the conventions begin?
And so some of the people, some of the groups in New York decided they were going to visit the group in Philadelphia in the late 30s. And when they were there, they had, you know, basically a big party. They were met each other and they decided that they were then going to plan to have a conference, a convention in New York in 1939 to coincide with the New York World's Fair. And so they started planning, and they decided they were going to have – the people in New York visited Philadelphia people, and the next year the people in Philadelphia went to visit the people in New York. And they later renamed these meetings. You know, it was basically just a couple of clubs coming together to meet. They later redesignated these as the first conventions. Even though they didn't really call them that. But they planned for the first science fiction world convention in 1939 in New York. And it was held. You know, a couple hundred people attended, including some people who drove all the way from Los Angeles. Ray Bradbury actually was a teenager at the time, but he hadn't begun writing, but he was very interested in science fiction. And
Ray Bradbury was one of the first people to attend what we now know as a science fiction convention.
Very first science fiction convention. He was just a teenager who loved science fiction, and he went there, and they had, you know, it was over the 4th of July weekend. They had, I think they had a softball game. I have to double check, but, they went to watch fireworks together. They basically, you know, bonded. I'm not sure if it's him per se, but one very active fan, Forrest Ackerman, who sort of has became legendary as probably like the most active fan. I mean, he had some competition, but a lot of people sort of celebrated him as the most active fan ever. He was into simplified spelling. And so he went by Forey instead of Forrest, and he decided he was going to spell his name for E. The idea of shortening things, playing with words, you know, that you get the cons, you get the fan, the mags, the zines. I suspect some of that comes out of just the fact that they were very creative. They were interlocked at different things, and they basically started coining all these phrases. Mm-hmm. You know, some of them like to have fun. Fun writing about it in letters, using sort of acronyms, manifests itself into the conventions. And very shortly thereafter, they began to some of them dressed up. Forrest Ackerman and a friend of his, arrived in costume, and so they sort of began doing these things that sort of event that continue. People continue to do for the next couple of decades, and they eventually, you know, have become this huge sort of phenomenon in some ways that exists parallel to and to the sort of science fiction publishing industry. But isn't necessarily known by people who, except, you know, those people who participate in them. I mean,
and then those are the kind of things that get attention from people on the outside. It's like, oh, something con is in town, and the streets are filled with people dressed up as their favorite hero.
There are these activities that people do as a result of participating in popular culture that extend far beyond reading. I just barely touch upon.
Well, one activity that you do spend a considerable amount of time talking about is actual science. But one of the groups you talk about is the American Interplanetary Society, and that sounds like some pie in the sky stuff, but they actually did, that group led to a group of people who actually did some useful
It's a very interesting, sort of fascinating twist to all of this. The American Interplanetary Society is probably the most successful and in some way most unusual, but, you know, still representative of a particular strand of activities that people involved in science fiction got involved with. Gernsback was quite serious in saying that science fiction, he wanted science fiction to inspire scientific activity. And one of in New York in early 1930, his associate editor for Science Wonder Stories, a man by the name of David Lasser, eventually began looking into rocketry, partially doing research for to sort of fact checking for some of the stories that are being written. But he began to look into rocketry. He shared his interest with some of the other people who were involved in science fiction who happened to live in the same area. And they got together for a few formal conversations, and they realized that they all had shared this mutual interest in pursuing what they initially called the interplanetary cause, basically traveling to another planet. And it sounds kind of crackpot.
Yes.
You know, but it's... they were quite serious about it. They began to look into rocketry. The first thing they did was they realized none of them had any background or training, so they educated themselves. They researched all the literature that was published. They made contact with people who were experimenting with rockets. They compiled a library of articles. They educated themselves, what they called the program of mutual enlightenment. But eventually eventually after they educated themselves, they decided, well, you know, other amateurs have, the Wright brothers built a plane and they succeeded in inventing, you know, heavier than air flight. There are plenty of examples of people who have experimented and we should do the same thing. So they decided they were going to actually begin to build rockets and launch them and, you know, work out the details of what would be necessary so that somewhere down the line, you could eventually build a rocket and go to the moon. That was their original plan, was they wanted to build a rocket and go to the moon.
They were going to literally shoot for the moon. Where did they wind up?
Well, so you know, they started building rockets and launching them. They learned from each rocket that they built. They tested a variety of different designs. You know, I mean, the first thing they figured out was, you know, basically the engines blow up.
And that could be bad, I guess.
They were trying to figure out, it's logical, actually. They you know, they tried a couple of designs and they said, well, you know, we need to work on the overheating problem because we don't, obviously the engines can't blow, we don't want to have engines blowing up. So they basically realized they need to scale back their efforts and they need to work on specific technical issues and problems. And that they actually had to do it in a kind of systematic way. Otherwise, they would just be sort of reinventing the wheel, you know, every time they tried something different.
So they were actually starting to behave like professionals in...
Yes, because as they actually, you know, I mean, the moment they launched, they began launching rockets, they actually got a lot of press. And actually, because many of them worked in the media and in journalism, they actually knew how to sort of manage press releases and things like that, sort of think about their image. But they realized that they kind of had to present a sort of legitimate and authoritative image. I mean, they were getting so many letters from science fiction readers who were thrilled at the fact that they were building rockets. And then when they found out that they had successfully launched a rocket, you know, they got even more publicity. So, and then right after Pearl Harbor, the attack on Pearl Harbor, the four of them who had already been in contact with the Navy decided they were going to form a company to manufacture, you know, engines based on this design. And the company the company was called Reaction Motors. They got bought out by Thiokol, which if people are not familiar with it, began as a chemical company in the 1920s and 30s, but realized that chemicals could be used as solid fuel for rockets, and so they also became a rocket manufacturer. And Thiokol bought up Reaction Motors, and itself became Thiokol is historically probably one of the largest defense contractors responsible for rocketry. Thiokol, I mean, the Reaction Motors part was kind of liquid fuel. Thiokol's the solid fuel. But between them, I mean, Reaction Motors built a engine for the X-1 rocket plane, which is the first to break the sound barrier. Thiokol, and between Thiokol and Reaction, I mean, the large conglomerate that became Thiokol, they built the engines for the Apollo, for Mercury, for Gemini, for the space shuttle.
To wrap things up, that was a really amazing example of what some of the themes that you talked about to begin with, the idea of amateurs and how they relate to professional practice, whether it be in publishing or in science fiction publishing. Just to close, if there's sort of one... There probably isn't just one point that you'd want to leave listeners with in, when they think about Astounding Wonder.
There is actually one. We don't live in a society where professional scientists can necessarily say, I dreamed about this and this is why I did it. You know, but some of it clearly does exist. Anecdotally, there's... from oral histories and stuff, there's all sorts of evidence that many of the people who wound up working in NASA and the space program were inspired by science fiction. You know, the space shuttle itself, the first one was named the Enterprise after the starship Enterprise from Star Trek. And what I'm trying to say is that we should both sort of recognize that there are human... sort of, you know, to humanize scientists and realize that, you know, that they do have outside interests and that's okay. And at the same time in which there are people who are science fiction fans who have, you know, legitimate abilities and interests and in science. And that the two of them are sort of interconnected. In ways, I think that if we didn't necessarily reserve science as being the domain of scientists and said, well, as a society, we should all be, you know, it's okay for us to really think of science as something that we should all learn and you know, sort of have some expertise in. That wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing. It would probably, help inform some of the debates, some of the really politicized debates about, you know, environmental issues, about evolution, you know, other sorts of things that are, that have become very politically charged.
John Cheng, thank you very much for taking time out to discuss your book, Astounding Wonder. And thank you for listening to this Penn Press podcast. For more information about Astounding Wonder and other Penn Press publications, please visit www.upenn.edu. Copyright University of Pennsylvania Press, 2012, all rights reserved.